Welcome to Highway Diaries. I'm your host, Eric Hollerbach. With me, very special guest, Tom Rhodes.
What's up, Eric?
Thank you so much for doing
Hello,
this.
Hello, listening world.
You are a big sweetie. I just want to get that out of the way.
My pleasure. I'm pro-comedy.
So let's start at the beginning, all right? You were, like, when Comedy Central was first emerging, you were kind of the original VJ of Comedy Central.
I was their boy, yeah.
Yeah.
Their little spokesperson, whatever the right title is.
You had some really cool shots where you were in a jail doing interstitials. Mark Maron was furious.
Yeah, they shot my jokes like they were a rock video. They did the first series of six, like in, it's called the Catacombs in New York City. It's this real tough jail.
Mm-hmm.
And even just filming there, I was happy to leave. But
did you think that there were some ghosts in there?
No, it's just creepy to be in like jail cells, you
yeah,
know,
yeah,
and
yeah.
think, you know, it's cute to shoot something, but you think about, oh, fuck, people are putting months and years into this.
Was it active at that point?
In different sections. We had this one section that was, it was open, and that's why we could film there. And it was shot beautifully. And
did anyone walk by and say, like, I could smell your cunt and throw jizz at you as you walked
no,
by?
No. We didn't. We weren't near anybody.
Oh, okay.
We got in and out. It was smooth. And then the next, those were popular, and then I got to do another series of six, and they shot them, like, on the you know, on the Hudson and some docks and shit. And
that's so
and,
cool.
The meatpacking plant before it grew up when it was still kind of dingy looking.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, that kind of, you know, that's where they said, you know, let's have this skinny long-haired dude be our fucking guy.
Yeah. So also I saw Viva Vietnam, which was that kind of was a whole documentary about you going to Vietnam and just to play on Comedy Central. And I saw that recently, and there was a, you rode on a taxidermy animal carousel, like actual bears were like killed
and
stuff.
And monkeys, yeah.
And monkeys and stuff. And also, you ordered a bat, right, at a restaurant, and in the background, the bat is screaming its fucking head off for 20 minutes before they finally chopped it.
And then they chopped it, and then you don't hear the screams anymore.
So,
they put a cleaver to his... Chopped his little head off.
So, is that the big thing that you noticed when you went over to Vietnam, the animal treatment? Because
I mean, God, you go to China, Vietnam, I mean, there's no respect for animals and animal life, whatever. If it's edible, they eat fucking insects and snakes and everything. That was a restaurant we went to. I never saw, I heard Anthony Bourdain went there, but I went there 10 years before.
Yeah.
And it was this restaurant, and they had little bears in cages and monkeys, and we ordered a cobra, and the guy brings the cobra out, and the waiter, and he throws it on the ground, and you know, Asia, everything's cinematic, you forget there's danger, you're like, wow, how exotic, this cobra is right 3 feet in front of me, and the waiter, it tastes better if it's pissed off, apparently, so the waiter starts smacking its nose, and then the cobra recoiled, its hood fanned open, and it made this fucking noise. I about shit in my pants. And it struck at the waiter, and he leaned back, and then he leaned in stealthily like a ninja and grabbed this cobra by the throat.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, they must go through three or four waiters a week, you think. But it was this thing. And then they, vodka and cobra blood, everybody is supposed to drink it, shots. And then the person of honor got the cobra heart.
Yeah,
they
still
put the cobra
the
heart,
glass.
And it's still beating in the glass. And they gave that to me, and because I was the person of honor, and I said, I ain't fucking doing that. And they were like, you're going to offend them. I was like, I don't give a fuck. I ain't drinking no cobra heart. I did a shot of the blood, you know, so.
Mm-hmm. So, and then that kind of Viva Vietnam, that kind of set the tone for your whole career of just traveling around the whole world. You know, this was way before... you know, your travel show in Holland and all that stuff. So was it Comedy Central's idea to go to Vietnam, or like what started that first thing?
That was actually my idea. I became like a junior filmmaker for them.
Mm-hmm.
They would let me do anything. They sent me to cover the Super Bowl in Atlanta.
Yeah.
They sent me to cover the Dream Team, the basketball team in Chicago. And
I
went on tour with the Horde Tour with, I had my own tour bus, and it was the Black Crows and Ziggy Marley. Sheryl Crow was on half the dates. And so they're letting me film all these things, sending me out on any little assignment. And I got a development deal with them, the first development deal they ever gave out. And I said, Bill Clinton had just opened Vietnam for Americans to travel there. It's like Cuba is now. We can't go there. It's illegal.
Mm-hmm.
My father had fought in Vietnam. He flew helicopters. He was shot down. Everybody died except for him and one other guy. He saves this guy. My dad got like 5 medals for this one incident. You know, documented war hero. And Vietnam was his life. It was so significant for him and his helicopter buddies especially. They got together every year for these reunions. And I said, what about letting me go to Vietnam? And it was like kind of a tribute to my dad. And the silly thing was I was going to go to Vietnam and have fun for the guys who went there and didn't get to have fun. And did some funny things. You know, the world's most China Beach, the world's most dangerous place to set up a slip and slide. did the Jane Fonda workout tape in Hanoi. These old women were doing Tai Chi. And veterans hate Jane Fonda because she went there at the height of the war and said America was wrong. And she's some prisoner of war. Gave her a note, and she told the Vietnamese soldiers, and that guy was, like, beaten for fucking months. So, like, she's just absolutely hated by veterans. So It was a cute, funny thing to do the Jane Fonda workout.
They were into it. Those old ladies
like, were into it.
Because, you know, they're like, hey, we're here to work out anyway. You pop in a Jane Fonda tape, and things get groovy.
And it was cool. That really meant a lot to my dad, too, that special. Comedy Central had the premiere at this place in Washington, D.C., and they had all these Vietnam veteran groups, people were there, and all these Vietnamese officials from the Vietnamese government that are in Washington, D.C. at their embassy and other places. And I had this real Charlie Chaplin moment in the back of the room watching these people laughing at my little hour special that I made. And, you know, they were fucking killing each other, like, not that long ago. And I think that is what put me on the map. I think that those little Comedy Central video rock star interstitials got me noticed. And then the Vietnam special, I got some nice reviews.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah. Then you had you went to NBC for a year. You had Mr. Rose. And then afterward, you seemed to be a little fed up with the whole business. And then you just bought this most pimp-ass apartment ever. And just stayed in New York.
Didn't buy it. I rented it.
Rented it. Yeah. And then just focus on stand-up.
I tried to. Yeah. I mean, it was a pretty wild time. Mitch Hedberg was one of my best friends. He was living at the Chelsea Hotel at the time. I was at 71 Broadway, right at the entrance of Wall Street. Weren't that far from each other.
I used to live right by Lincoln Center. Or went to
awesome. And, man, you know, it's so exciting when you're in New York. To, you know, I would start, you know, I'd take the red one train up to, you know, the Upper West Side. I'd start out at, like, the comic stand up New York. You'd then go over to the comic strip on the East Side and Caroline's, wherever, and then always ending up at the Comedy Cellar and then setting it up like 4 or 5 sets in a night. Man, I would shoot up that one subway car all the way up to the top, Upper West Side, Manhattan. And then like a pinball in a pinball machine, I would just bing, 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 work my way down the island of Manhattan. And it's really exciting, man, from going from stage to taxi to stage to taxi. And it's such an accelerated way of doing comedy. It's great.
Yeah, you can just do so many more sets in a night than in L.A., you know?
Right, and, you know, Dave Attell is there.
Yeah.
Louis C.K., Dave Chappelle,
Jim Norton, Patrice
was always there. Yeah. And
did you always get into like the shit talking battles in the back with Patrice?
Not with Patrice. No, I didn't really. I mean, we knew each other. Patrice had done Edinburgh in 2000, and I just went there for a week. And some comedian, it was some all New York show. Some guy was fed up and he left. He just pulled out. He went back to New York. There's like a week left in the festival, something like that. And somebody asked me to cover because I was just there for a week. And I got to share an apartment with Patrice in Edinburgh.
Oh, that's cool.
And it's great, man. He's cooking up fried chicken. I'm from the South. I eat like a black man. My wife tries to change that. But, man. And so he and I would sit up late and just talk about comedy. And he was like, fuck these people. you know, England, everything here is stupid. Their coins are stupid. Look at the coins. They're designed, they get heavy, you get too many in your pocket, you don't want to spend it. Stupid. And he just was like critical about everything. It was so funny. And we were on the same show. So, I mean, that's really where he and I became friends, you know? I mean, that New York scene was incredible.
That's got to be, like, the greatest incubator for talent, you know, the Cellar, around, especially around
I've really had, I've had such a great circumstance in my life. Like, when I was in my early 20s, I moved to San Francisco for the early 90s. And, you know, it was Patton Oswalt, Greg Proops, Margaret Cho, all these incredible comedians were there, Mark Maron, and Hedberg came around later. And then to be in the New York scene later with all these guys. Yeah. I mean, it's when you're around, you know, such talented guys, it makes you, you know, raise your game. And
then all of a sudden, 2002, you're in the Netherlands doing the Kevin Master show starring Tom Rhodes. And then you had you had Steve-O on. You had a bunch of acts from America that kind of
Tenacious D came on. I gave him a tour of Amsterdam. That was fun.
You mentioned in the Tenacious D one. I saw that segment today where you were like, your favorite game to play in Holland was hold my weed while
Officer,
I tie my shoes.
Will you hold my bag of weed while I tie my shoe?
That's real.
And they'll do it. They'll sit there and hold it. I mean, it's legal.
Yeah,
no big deal.
Is it still the? Because I hear that they're getting wishy washy on the.
Some places won't serve foreigners, and that's mostly to protect the border regions, where these little villages, people from Germany come over on the eastern border, and people from rural Belgians come up from the southern border, and they get high and drunk and wipe their dick on the curtains. So they're. But in Amsterdam, you wouldn't have a problem.
Because yeah, if you just
too much money. And the Dutch are all about business.
Yeah.
They don't smoke weed. They look down on people that smoke weed. Mm-hmm. They know people want to smoke weed. They make money off of it. Mm-hmm. In Dutch society, they would look down on you if you went to prostitutes. That's not a. They're very kind of Calvinistic Christian working people. They believe in partying and blowing off some steam, but after you've worked a 60-hour week, you know, you just don't party all the time.
And the whores are
and
just
so, like, in the prostitutes, it's like, these are money makers. They're business people, historically smart business people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's more an economic thing than so much of a liberal, open-minded attitude.
In the envy segment of David Tell's Insomniac, he visits you, and he's completely envious of your lifestyle, and he just hangs out with you and gets really depressed about how much of a killer life you have. Did anyone from the Insomniac crew, like, did they work on your stuff in your Comedy Central days?
Well,
the producers or anybody from the crew?
I forget. I remember it was a director. Yeah, it was someone I knew. And then the Comedy Central people were, and some of the people are still there.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the people that worked at early Comedy Central went on to do great things in the business and different producing of excellent television. But yeah, there were a lot of people. I seem to think of it. I can't think of any names, but it was, I was really touched. Dave is coming over to film Insomniac in Amsterdam, and I'm doing this late night talk show, and he keeps asking me if I'm going to be there, and I said, yeah, man, I can't wait to see you, brother, and hang out, you know, been a while. And I thought we were going to get together as friends when he was done filming.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think he was going to include me, and it was such a genius concept that he went there with. To go to Amsterdam to experience the seven deadly sins. Mm-hmm. And it was so intelligent that he had me be envy. That he's envious of me. And, oh my God, it was really great. So what you ended up seeing on that television show, the final, what was aired, when I take him out on Amsterdam, you know, he comes to see me taping my late night talk show, and he's all depressed in the audience. And then I took him out. It was two separate evenings that they cut into one. And I was having a really good time there. Life was really nice, and I was single. And, okay, there were...
You were getting models
There were a lot of women around
there
me when we would go to some of these nightclubs. But the way they cut that together... Oh, my God, I look like Elvis Presley. I'm just, like, surrounded with all these women, and... you know, it was a little exaggerated, but it wasn't that far from the truth. And Dave played that comedically brilliant, like just Chaplin or Buster Keaton. Just, you know, and I was really I was really flattered that he had me in it, you know?
Yeah, that was so cool.
That's an all-time classic episode of Insomniac.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wait. Also, you had Steve-O on your show as well.
Yeah.
And is it true they stapled his balls on your...
He stapled his balls...
Was that during the Jackass promotion days or what?
He said... It was when the first movie came out.
Okay.
And he's there for the premiere. And he said that it was... I said, you can do whatever you want on... He comes out smoking a joint and he's saying fuck and all that. And he's apologizing. I go, don't apologize. Bro, it's Dutch television. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, really? I can do whatever I want? And I said, yeah, there's no censorship on Dutch television. So he goes, whose dick do I have to suck to get a stapler? And, you know, in television edit time, a stapler instantly appears. But it was like 3 or 4 minutes somebody went off to find a stapler.
Mm-hmm.
And he spreads his nutsack. He drops his pants, spreads his nutsack out on his thigh like it's silly putty. And takes the stapler and stapled it through his nutsack, and his scrotum is stuck to his thigh epidemal matter. And
he just left it in there and continued the interview.
It's sad. So, he's standing. It could only hold for about 6 seconds. But yeah, he was a lunatic. And then I went out. I took him out after he stuck around after the taping, because it was at the Rosengracht Theater. On Rosenstraat, right by the, it's in the Jordaan, which is like the Greenwich Village of Amsterdam. And I filmed in this beautiful old theater. There was a bar area in the front. And after, you know, get out of the monkey clothes and, you know, talk to your producers and stuff, and we would all come out and have a drink out front, and boom, he's waiting for me. He's, you're a cool dude, man. I want you to show me around Amsterdam. And so I took him out to some clubs, and we're having a good time. We went to some place, people didn't recognize him. So he took off his shirt, and he's got that big tattoo of his face on his back. And then people recognized him. I thought it was kind of sad that he had to take off his shirt so people would recognize him. But he's a lunatic. He was a lunatic. I heard he's cleaned up. But so we're partying, and... he liked some girl that was with like three guys, and then I was off talking to some other people, and then at like 3 o'clock in the morning, he goes, hey man, let's go to Utrecht. These people want to go to Utrecht. And you know, that's like, it's like fucking 35 kilometers from Amsterdam. That's mm-hmm. would be like, you know, if you're in LA and somebody said, let's go to Riverside. It's like, why would we leave this great here and go 35 kilometers? So, he goes with those people, and then he disappeared. The next day, MTV ran bulletins. He missed all these interviews. MTV kept running bulletins all day. Steve-O is missing. Last seen on Kevin Masters. If you've seen Steve-O, please email us. Because he had all the shit that he was supposed to do for MTV, and he didn't. And then it was on the, like, Entertainment Tonight of Holland. He's missing. And then the second night, he comes on Entertainment Tonight of Holland. It's called... RTL Boulevard, and they're asking him what happened. He's like, oh, I went out with Tom Rhodes, and we're partying, I'm in this club, and I meet these people, and I say, hey, let's go to Utrecht. And Tom said, you don't want to go to Utrecht, dude. But I went to Utrecht. And it was like, he's kind of a lovable buffoon.
Was he throwing you under the bus a little bit there?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe, but at least I didn't go to Utrecht.
Funny. So also, more recently, you did Colossus of Me, which was a double album,
yeah.
And in the same year, Light, Sweet, Crude. Well, after your double album, you're like, I got some stuff to say. I got more material in the chamber. Why did you release all that stuff? All
no, no, no. Well, I get, probably should have given it one name, because it's all material of the same era.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I wanted to make a new CD. And that's what I was focusing on. And I had the name Colossus of Me, because Colossus of Rhodes. And I recorded in Los Angeles at the Ice House, and I thought, this is perfect. This is great. And then, like, just a couple months later, I was in Sydney, Australia, as I'm editing the LA thing, trying to get it together. And I have this wonderful run of shows at the Comedy Store in Sydney, one of my favorite clubs on the planet. And I had recorded... one of the nights, and I'm listening to that, I'm like, God, I don't know which one to release.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Sydney had like a lot, there was a lot of international people there from all over the world. So I got out a lot of jokes about countries and stories about me in these different countries, things that have happened to me. And then I thought, fuck it, why not, you know, make a double? Half the material is the same on each disc, but then there's tons of different. And then you can see how it works in the United States versus Australia, like mm-hmm. different countries. And, you know, it only costs 50 cents more to freaking put out two.
Yeah.
And, you know, why not? And then later in the year, I was offered the special.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like, I'm doing this. I want to put out this this era of work now, you know. And then Light Sweet Crude was just another great name I had in my head
mm-hmm.
because it's the most expensive kind of oil.
And you don't talk much about oil in that special. Well, anyway, I was ready to watch it going, he's going to solve the oil crisis right here. Here it comes.
I should have. I thought it more described my comedy style. It's light, it's sweet, it's crude.
Oh, okay. Yeah I can see that.
I should have talked about oil. I should have went on an OPEC dissertation.
You move around a lot on stage, I notice. You're always walking around when you're delivering your jokes, and you have sort of like a preacher cadence. It's like, you know, which is different, you know?
It's rhythmic.
And you say that you're moving around on stage as a temple dance to honor the spirits of the universe.
Yeah.
That's a religious thing for you.
To cleanse the impurities from my soul.
To walk around to do the dance?
Yeah, I mean, in like kind of a shamanistic kind of way. I mean, if you're doing so many shows and you're on the road, sometimes it becomes a bit repetitious. But, you know, if you're going up there with, you know, this truth-seeking shaman dance element to it, you know, it's got to add a little...
And the rhythm of the speech, it kind of like after you're talking for 40 minutes, you know, it kind of just like... Then the layers dip into the subconscious of your audience, and you have them hypnotized. You know what I mean?
Nice, I like it. Yeah, I always loved Southern Black preachers and the way they elongate their syllables and really hit the continents. You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you know, my mother's had a lot of religious television on TV and mm-hmm. through the years. I don't know. I just always, you know, I like the Black Southern preacher. Coming to work it out.
Mm-hmm. Road Scholar. You have another DVD, and it's stand-up, and then also documentary little field pieces that has been like kind of like the essence of throughout your career. It's like you're always traveling and making these little things. And also I saw the sizzle reel for Road Warrior, and I thought it was fascinating. You were talking to Malaysian comics, and they were talking about how, you know, being Muslim and comedy and all that stuff, and so is that the next thing you really want to do? Is this Road Warrior?
I've been working on that for a couple years, man, trying to make a comedy travel show.
It's so badass.
The way Anthony Bourdain goes around the world, and it's all about food, and he meets chefs. I want to go check out comedy scenes and highlight comedians from those places. It's basically the life that I'm living.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got great comedy friends all over the world. I had never been to Malaysia, and I had this premise for the show about, you know, what are people making jokes about in other countries? And you know, how my jokes work as an American in different countries. So I put a little money into making a pilot of the Malaysia thing. And that, my manager got me in the door with Comedy Central and Travel Channel and BBC America, but they ended up passing on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm still trying to make that show.
Mm-hmm.
And still making videos on my own. I'm obsessed with it. And I just put up a new one on Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
And gonna have one on Rome soon in New Zealand. So I spent a month in New Zealand doing the New Zealand Comedy Festival this year in Auckland for 2 weeks. And then I did a 2-week tour where I went all over.
Do you think that it's the type of thing where like the networks will be like, when you make self-produced 6 episodes, then we'll buy it from you or whatever?
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, the beauty of right now is you can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
So I'm putting them on YouTube. And making my podcast, which is also like an extension of the same idea, because it's me going around the world and talking to comedians,
mm-hmm.
And you know, from all over the world. And I think that's what makes my podcast different, and it's got a lot of variety, and it's all an extension of the same idea. It's my life. It's me traveling the world as a comedian, and all these weird, interesting, beautiful...
And I love your podcast, and I like how you, you know, clip in little pieces of stand-up so people can get a real sense of...
So the... somebody would... I want whoever is listening to like, become a fan of this comedian. And, I, you know, I don't put bullshit people on. It's always people that I respect or admire, and I'll slice in some snippets of a couple hunks of their stand-up, because I want them to... create fans.
It's like a proper like audio documentary, you know what I mean? Like This American Lifestyle. You're just like showcasing their life, you know what I mean? It's great. You also do you write stories for the Huffington Post.
Mm-hmm.
Fried chicken has already come up in this, you know, and in your blog, fried chicken comes up a lot. Mm-hmm. And we'll get into this later, but your happiness part of your blog, it's like fried chicken comes up a lot. And you did a thing of Prince's Hot Chicken in Nashville.
Yeah.
It's like food porn. Tell me about, why do people have to go to Nashville?
It's Prince's Hot Chicken is, it's in the ghetto. It's in the sweaty part of town where, like, tires are being changed and, pallets are being stacked. And it's this real ghetto place, and it's they have this spicy hot chicken, and it's incredible. I like really spicy stuff, but I can only handle the medium. And it's unfortunate. My wife told me to cut it out of this story, this one line. When you take a bite of this Prince's Hot Chicken, you get this waterfall of cold rush that runs over you and down your body, and you don't know if... you're going to come or shit your pants.
God damn, that sounds like
chicken. That is a hell of a piece of chicken.
You're also big into Elvis, and you take pictures of an Elvis doll. You know,
yeah, I stopped doing that. His face got a little dirty, and yeah, I got a wife now. When I was lonely, I was doing that.
Also, you... have a bit in Light Street Crude about Elvis, and you know, I don't want to spoil this, but you're saying that he had someone on his entourage who would pick burger pieces out of his mouth.
Oh, yeah.
That he didn't choke to death.
Yeah,
and I think that's fascinating, because it's like you know, you can tell the dichotomy of like, this is the most iconic person ever in entertainment, and then someone on his entourage when he would pass out.
I got that out of there was a great book. It was called The Elvis Syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy was a huge Elvis fan, and he was a psychologist, worked with a lot of famous people, movie stars, and just people that just had millions and millions of dollars and could do whatever the fuck they wanted. And all throughout this book, he's talking about, you know, after Elvis's mother died, nobody was there to say, hey, don't do that. That's stupid. He didn't have anybody. So he would ride around his swimming pool on a little motorbike, not a motorcycle, those little mini bikes.
Like a scooter?
Just like in circles for like hours. Nobody would say, don't do that. So that's where I read the thing about the guy had to dig out the cheeseburger
chunk. I
got it from that book. So if anybody's fact checking the jokes, it's from that book.
Now I wonder if like Elvis was like, listen, sometimes I pass out and I don't want to die. So, he was passed out in front of three people on his entourage, and then one of them's like, well, you know, we should like get the burger pieces out of his mouth so he doesn't.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like that's the only. If anyone's really fact checking on the source, whose fingers those were, how they got recruited for that job. I saw a documentary on Elvis, and he would always, like, get fucked up on mescaline and do karate.
Oh, wow.
Like, I saw him in a dojo just, like, throwing real haphazard karate chops and stuff around.
Did you ever see This Is Elvis?
Maybe.
Documentary. You can see it online. There's a lot of great documentaries. I watch it traveling a lot. It's called topdocumentaryfilms.com, and there's tons of great stuff by the BBC. I've watched all their ones on philosophy and great stuff on there. I know this is on there. It's called This Is Elvis.
Mm-hmm.
Not BBC, but somebody made this like 20 years ago. It's a documentary about Elvis and all this movie footage that had never been seen. And he's in the back of his limousine, and he's got his sunglasses on. And he doesn't realize he's being filmed. And he's going, Sonny, that girl you sent to my dressing room last night, she gave the best head, man. That girl, man, she gave the best head. And they all, Sonny in red, his little... minions crack up and they go, Elvis, you're on film. And without missing a beat, Elvis just goes, what a friend we have in Jesus.
That guy was partying at Levi's.
He could turn on a dime from scumbag to saint. Like in,
that cleansed the palate. If you just start singing about Jesus, then... I also saw this one documentary where, like, towards the end when he was all bloated and fat, like, after a karate, like, there was a group of people just watching him for whatever reason, and he went to, like, go kiss one of the girls in the group, and she, like, turned her face, you know? Mm. And then he just kind of, like moved his hand all mysteriously, like, just to ease over the rejection.
Oh, wow.
That's the Elvis that I can relate to.
Wow.
You have a section of your website of just things that make you happy, you know? And, you know, I guess you're on the road sometimes and, you know, you're in Burbank and you're like, oh, my wife's not around, you know, so I need some things to make me happy. I agree. I want to list a couple that I really liked. Number 5, nipples like pencil erasers.
Hooray.
Hooray. Every Hooray. Now and then, it's just a genetic thing.
Nipples like pencil erasers.
Sometimes on a first date, then you're like, oh, you got the nipple.
Yeah.
Eraser pencil. Bill Murray, of course. That Muhammad Ali is a Capricorn. Now, why did you write that one down? You found
like I'm a Capricorn, so I it makes me happy because Muhammad Ali is one of the saints in my church.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was a prophet, and just you know things he said when America needed to hear it. Just the heroic way he fought and lived his life, and even the bravery of converting to Islam. You know. And he was good friends with Sam Cooke when he beat Sonny Liston in Miami. And Sam Cooke was like real, you know, Southern Baptist Christian guy. I mean, really complex, interesting. I love Muhammad Ali. And it makes me happy that he's a Capricorn. Because Capricorns are great leaders.
You got that same power.
That's right.
Number 35 on your list, skinny brown women with no tits.
Yeah.
Any comment?
I have always been turned on by skinny brown women with no tits. I like ethnicity. Mm-hmm. I've always dated a lot of foreign women, and I am an ass man. I could care less about titties. And big titties, some guys are crazy about big titties. I love small, little, beautiful titties, or no titties with a great nipple.
Because littler you know? Titties, it seems like they're in the middle of blossoming.
They're just women are the highest form of art on the planet. And my particular favorite, if we were talking just aesthetically on the outside, skinny brown women with no tits.
Number 54 on your list of things that make you happy, getting your hair cut by a pregnant woman. I had this experience recently, and that's what, and you know, the belly's on your shoulder.
Yeah.
Sometimes you feel a little movement. Sometimes you feel a little kick, and they're just, you know, leaning over you.
This girl I went to high school with, she's remained one of my best friends my whole life, Janine. It was years ago, and she was pregnant, and she cut hair for a very long time. And exactly, or the belly's on you while she's cutting, and just like, just something very calming about that you're being... nurtured by Mother Earth and a woman doing life's purpose, and it was very calming.
And the belly is warm too. It's this big warm orb that's incubating something. You know,
right.
When it's on your face. When
there should be haircut places where they only have pregnant women cutting hair. Why have we not? I don't know why we don't. I'm looking for investors.
Number 97, my Bob Dylan fan club sheriff's badge that my friend Jim Short gave to me. That is quite an item. Bob Dylan sheriff's badge.
He makes them out of recycled automobiles that are like melted down and shit.
It takes a whole automobile.
No. When they melt down all this steel and shit, he uses it from that recycled steel. And they're these little metal, and it says Bob Dylan fan club, and it's like a sheriff's. Wow. Badge star, and my friend Jim Short and I both love Bob Dylan. He gave that to me, and it meant a lot to me. I cherished it, had it for a very long time. I was still somewhat skinny and sexy, and I would wear it on my jeans on the top,
yeah,
because I was, you know, wore my shirt out, it would kind of be under my shirt flap, and people, you know, maybe if I put my hand in my pocket, somebody would see it. It was just, I like knowing it was there. I was at a party in Paris after a show, and there was some grifter, poet, performance artist people there, and they kept asking me about it and shit, and I proceeded to get very drunk, and it was people bumping into each other, very tight people packed into a small place, and one of those dirty son of a bitches stole it.
Unbelievable.
And, you know, the old trick of bumping into somebody, and I mean, who knows? But, I mean,
so someone pickpocketed.
So it's like during this party, and I'm drunk, and at one point I look down, I'm like, hey, God damn it, where's my badge? My Dylan, you know, and I'm drunk, I'm raising my voice, I'm ready to stop the party. And I could see in their eyes they might have done it. A year later, maybe two, I went to see Bob Dylan in concert again, and he was still selling those badges, so I bought another one.
Oh, sick.
So, hey, Paris people, if you're listening, well done.
Number 137 on your list. Anti-white people, anti-power structure literature, and other forms expression about... So you like literature that's anti-white people.
Yeah.
You read a lot of this...
Yeah.
Okay. That seems very straightforward. Number 154, the amount of ass I kicked on stage in Hong Kong last night on my China tour.
Yeah.
Well done there. 214, Third World Cops.
Third World Cops.
you love Third World Cops, because I'm afraid of Third World Cops, because they tell you that, you know, if you go to Mexico...
Well, in case one of them ever reads my happiness list and I get in trouble down there, maybe they might let me go.
I hear, you know, you could get pulled over in Mexico, and then they're just like, oh, do you have $500, and then we'll let you
go. Yeah, that's Mexico. Stuff. Other parts of the world, I mean, there's lots of bribery and corruption. We don't realize in the States, because we don't see it.
Right.
Our corruption. In a lot of countries, corruption's a day-to-day occurrence. But a lot of third world cops are really cute and helpful.
Kind of cute because they're shorter.
Yeah.
In certain countries. 357, pimp steak. What's a pimp steak?
Just a funny combination of words that, you know, I write things in my notebook all the time that, you know. Just words that sound good together.
Just sounded delicious.
Sounded good. Pimp steak.
Where's Tom Rose eating pimp steak?
Like, it was a compliment I gave somebody, man.
That's a pimp steak.
You are so pimp steak.
Number 1,169. Knowing that entertainment is America's greatest export around the world.
We don't make the best cars anymore. We don't make the best television sets. The best thing, the United States, our biggest export to the world is our entertainment. So that's why when, like, politicians go on about Hollywood and shutting down Hollywood, they can all fuck off, because it's our industry of entertainment, whether it's movies, comedy, music, the entertainment industry is our best contribution to the world.
And speaking about being an ambassador, international ambassador, if you're a development executive out there who can tell his dick from his asshole, pick up Road Warrior and, you know, watch what goes on, how many minds are opened by the, you know, into a higher level of consciousness, because they learn to laugh at themselves. You know what I mean? So I just want to give it a plug there. You're going to go to Europe right after this. This podcast is
tomorrow, flying to Rome.
Look at that. So by the time this airs, you're going to be well in Europe. It's going to air 8/27. Then you'll be in Chicago at Zany's September 17th to 22nd. Then you'll be in Zany's in Rosemont, Illinois, September 25th to 28th at Zany's. I got some spots coming up. Comedy Store Belly Room, Saturday 8/31 at 10 p.m. Flapper's Main Room, Tuesday, September 3rd at 10 p.m. And the links are there. You want to do some news stories? There's an app that turns your sex life into statistics.
Huh.
So you'll have your pocket. I'm not exactly sure if you have to, like, log into the app, but the app is listening to your sexual activity, calculating the decibels, calculating the thrusts, calculating the, you know, the length of duration and all that stuff. And you have all the statistics right there. I mean, you can earn badges for certain.
I don't know why there would ever be war or unhappiness after this.
Do you think that angry husbands would look at the statistics and be like, look, since our honeymoon, our fucking...
Well, yeah, you know, your numbers are always going to plummet. Yeah, it's not the same game anymore. I don't know. That's weird. That's like a, that's a bizarre app. I've got some good apps.
Yeah?
The light. That's the best one.
The flashlight.
The flashlight. That's the fucking best app there is.
Tom Rose, this has been such a complete honor for me to have you on my podcast.
Thanks for knowing so much about me, man, and for caring, you know? I mean, it's like, if people didn't fucking give a shit about you, it'd be really, you know, it's just nice when somebody, you know, says, hey, man, I like what you're doing.
So I've been geeking out in mad preparation, researching like a New York Times reporter, going through the microfiche. And
fantastic.
This has been such a thrill for me. Thank you so much.
Respect, my brother.
All right.
Thanks, Eric.
Thanks a lot, man. Wow. Tom Rhodes was just on my podcast. I have to put you guys in my shoes for a second here. So I had him on right after we go to Flappers, you know, my main stay. And in between the first show and the second show, I was like, hey, Tom, you know, you think you can get me 5 minutes? And he worked it out real quick. Got me on, and you know, I did my filthy, disgusting cum jokes to mixed reaction, to be honest. You know, I'm not gonna sugarcoat my performance. I wish I did better, but then Tom gets up, he fucking destroyed. Then after the show, there was this you know, guy who worked at Flappers who was like, oh man, let me tell you something, a lot of headliners come through here, they don't say shit to me. Headliners come through here, they don't say shit to me. I wanted to get Tom Rhodes a beer because he said hello to me. He spent the time to talk to me. So, let me just say to people out there, Tom Rhodes is just the sweetest fucking guy ever. So, he also said as he was leaving, you know, we smoked a number, we had a little chat, he got a bunch of nuts at 7-Eleven. You know, it was just great to hang out with him. So great. He's gonna, you know, he said he'll do the podcast again in like a year from now. And all I hope is that a year from now, I'll already be on the bill and I'll fucking destroy in front of him. And not say enough good things about Tom Rhodes. Go see him. Check out his podcast, Tom Rhodes Radio. The guy is the classiest fucking dude out there. And also, I forgot to say, click through my Amazon link on the RSS fucking page. Because, you know, it helps keep this podcast free. I got that web series. I keep editing it together. It's called Here Comes Godot. That'll be out around February 2014. Also around February 2014, Theater of the Deranged 2, the horror anthology that I hosted as Damien Shadows. And then after all that stuff kicks off, then we'll have a Damien Shadows Kickstarter for more Damien Shadows web series episodes. So that's another episode, the Highway Diary in the motherfucking bag. Big thanks to my guest and my new comedy guru. Oh my God, this guy is the greatest thing in the world. Tom Rhodes. Later.